Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Happy Monday. Well, never mind about resurrecting the economy on Easter. Trump has bowed to medical reality and moved the date back to at least the end of April. And after months of downplaying the pandemic, he's now suggesting that 100,000 Americans may die. And we're supposed to think this is good news. So I was actually on Morning Joe earlier this morning, and they were, touting, we got to give the president credit for listening to the science and for getting it right. And there were actually comparisons to FDR, which I kind of had to push back on all of that, because I don't. Trump's an arsonist who wants to be given credit for being a fireman. Now, I may have ripped that off from JVL, or it may be great minds think alike. I'm leaning toward the I ripped it off from him. But there's a pattern here where Trump creates a crisis, says something, batshit crazy, and then pretends that he didn't mean it, or that he alone can solve the problem that he created 24 hours earlier, and he knows a lot of folks are going to buy it. So in my newsletter this morning, I included a tweet from Judd Legum, who said, 1 month ago, Trump said there were only 15 coronavirus cases in the United States, and that in just a few days, it would be zero, and that proves he's doing a good job. Well, today, Trump said that if 100,000 people die of coronavirus in the United States, that proves he's doing a good job. This would be called moving the goalposts, but that's just one aspect of this crazy time that we live in, and we are joined by our good friend Adam White once again on the podcast today. Good morning. Happy Monday, Adam.
Good morning. Happy Monday, Charlie.
Well, I also had to post. I'm glad things are moving more or less in the right direction, but I do think that every once in a while you need to stop and hope that some historian of the future, some chronicler of our times, notes that in the middle of this massive crisis where, the refrigerator trucks are pulling up to house dead bodies in New York, that the president of the United States was tweeting about his ratings. Yeah. You saw that? The ratings? President Trump is a ratings hit. And he's going on about, with all the numbers and comparing himself to the kind of numbers that you get for The Bachelor. This is the president of the United States. I just don't think Abraham Lincoln was, talking about his ratings.
No, that really was a horrific tweet. Now, Lincoln did talk about popular support. And of course, we need popular support, but I don't think he meant popularity in terms of the Nielsen ratings. You mentioned Lincoln. I think a lot about this crisis. And for the last couple of years, I've been thinking about what the framers thought of as steady administration of the laws. Hamilton, when he gave his defense of executive power in Federalist 70, said you need an energetic executive for a few reasons, but first and foremost is defending us against foreign attacks and the steady administration of the laws at home. And now it's safe to say President Trump was so asleep at the switch for the 2 months that we had before the virus really landed on our shores and seeded itself among our communities that he failed that test. But now, as we sort of look forward to the long struggle to control this virus, we need to think of it in terms of steady administration. And while I'm glad the president seems to be migrating in the right direction, there's no sense in which his administration of the policies and laws at issue are steady. They're the opposite of it. And as a constitutional matter, that's very, very worrisome.
You can also break that down into several different categories. Clearly, they were not just asleep at the switch when it came to testing and making sure that we had the right infrastructure. You not only had administrative and bureaucratic problems, but you also had the signaling coming from the administration. And the bat signal that went out that this is no big deal, that in fact this was overhyped by the media, that it was part of a Democratic plan to take down the president. Now he's backed off on that somewhat, but the reality is that those seeds were planted out there in Trump world, and a lot of people have taken this signal. Last week I was talking about a case in Wisconsin where you had a major company that's basically telling its workers to come to work, and it's owned by two of Donald Trump's biggest and most enthusiastic contributors, the E-lines, and they're big into this. Media is overhyping this. We can't panic people. So I guess I'm sort of backing into this. The fact is that there are still people in the world who don't take this seriously, in part because of the not only the lack of president's leadership, but the misinformation he put out here. And I do think McKay Coppins from The Atlantic is right that this has now become the latest form of social identity signaling. Do you take this seriously or you don't? And you are seeing dramatically different responses. And that has real-world consequences. And frankly, Adam, I mean, that also comes to the question of presidential leadership. And I think even President Trump is realizing you can't turn on a dime. You can't plant a narrative and a meme out there and then just simply go, hey, never mind.
Yeah, there are limits to what even President Trump can accomplish with his base. Obviously, parts of his base follow him. And we see this on Fox News, the radical switch, the dislocation of views from the downplaying of the virus to suddenly the upplaying of the virus. Or more specifically, upplaying President Trump's role in combating the virus. It's been just head spinning. But you're right, that initial sort of that initial setting of expectations and views, the signals, we used to have virtue signaling, now we have virus signaling, really had effects. Take, for example, Florida, where Governor DeSantis, yes, who's really tied himself more closely to not just President Trump's policies, but his affectation. They are in a very dangerous situation, and I'm speaking as somebody with loved ones in Florida. I'm really terrified of the situation down there, precisely because Florida has been so slow to catch up to where it needs to be. This is very dangerous.
And you do have to ask how much of this is driven by politics rather than by medical expertise. Yeah. This is also a moment where you see the strengths and the weaknesses of the federal system. You know, some of the strongest leadership that we've seen has come from the governors, but also some of the weakest. I mean, the contrast between the aggressive action, and this, by the way, bipartisan, DeWine in Ohio and in Cuomo in New York being very, very aggressive. And then you have DeSantis in Florida being very laid back. And what's the guy down in Mississippi who's just like, was it Reeves? Just completely absurd. And so you do wonder the... we've had it described as the laboratories of democracy, and it's like, yes, it's become rather literal. It's like, yeah. petri dishes of democracy.
You know, that's right. It's I think the challenge here is not just the system, but it's the misunderstanding of the system. Every day we spend, you know, the world seems to stop to watch what President Trump says for 90 minutes on the stage, when in fact he's very little of what he talks about are things that he can actually do. As a matter of law, almost all of the most important public health, at least in terms of on-the-ground public safety measures, those are imposed by governors and mayors who are seeing things from a certain perspective with certain incentives and responsibilities. President Trump can announce these guidelines. And of course, the things that the FDA and the CDC do are important, and the president's powers under the Defense Production Act are important. But in terms of curfews, social distancing, and so on, that's really the stuff of governors. I think one of the challenges right now, and actually the biggest challenge overall, is unpacking the multiple roles the president has sort of assumed in a crisis, unpacking those roles down to where they belong. And that's unpacking real perceived and actual responsibility for public safety, you know, first and foremost to governors and mayors. Unpacking policymaking authority back to Congress. And we saw some of that with the recent I want to say stimulus act, but really a relief act. And then finally, and I think most important, is unpacking this information power that's been primarily from the White House podium, including Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx. And while that's unavoidable and important in the short run, it's unsustainable and counterproductive in the long run to have the White House being the central focus of attention for getting out information. And it's time that we unpack that back to experts in other parts of government and at large. And Congress has a role they can play there, too.
Okay, what is that role? That's an interesting point, because I think it's almost, it has been assumed that the White House would be the focal point, right? I mean, if the President of the United States is going to come out and he's going to have the nation's medical experts standing behind him, you know, what better source of information? I'm playing devil's advocate here. So why not?
Not even devil's advocate. I'd say in the immediate outbreak of a crisis, the president constitutionally becomes the focal point of our system, and he's in the best position to quickly marshal the scientific and expertise and other expertise that's within the administration, and there's a lot of it. So it makes sense that the president can quickly call a task force, including Dr. Fauci and others, and make them sort of the central source of information. And it's good because in those opening days where we're all getting our feet under ourselves, it's good to be able to turn to that focused source of attention. But there's a tension within that relationship because on the one hand, there's expertise. On the other hand, these people are all, whether they like it or not, part of the president's team. And a president is always going to have expectations about what people say in public versus in private. And it's good that the president's getting candid advice in private. But the problem is if he doesn't go with that advice, then as we've seen, especially with the press surrounding Dr. Fauci, there's a constant pull to amplify the disagreements between the people in his team and outside of his team. It's only going to get worse as we near the presidential election. And so in this piece I'm working on now, I think one of the points I stress is it's time now to disaggregate that information role. Unfortunately, it's probably unavoidable that Dr. Fauci is always going to be working first and foremost from within the president's team, and I'm glad the president's getting his advice. But it means the public as a whole needs to pivot towards other sources of information. And Congress, Evan and I have a piece coming out soon in National Review on the role of Congress. And one of the things that we say is Congress needs to play a leading role in distributing information by convening hearings, probably not in person right now, but virtual hearings or some sort of way to collect expertise that isn't from within the president's team, credible expertise, and bringing it, elevating it to a public stage so that we're not all constantly obsessing over what Dr. Fauci says and trying to figure out to what extent he and President Trump are not on the same page.
So that's what you mean by disaggregating the information is to have Congress be a different source of the information?
Not just Congress. Congress isn't so much a source of information, but rather as a convener, a collector, okay, and amplifier of information.
All right. This is a very interesting point because we've asked this question over and over again in recent years. What is the role of Congress? Are they simply potted plants? Where is the oversight function? Many of us are old enough to remember when congressional hearings were major news events, when they really were the central theater. Right now, there's nothing. Now, in part, it's because nobody wants to get together. But this would seem to be exactly the moment for both the House and the Senate to hold hearings, bring experts in, provide a forum for them to say what's happening, what is needed right now, what should our agenda be, and then at some later time, do sort of a 9/11 commission type thing, like how did we get here? How did we screw this up? Lessons learned.
Yeah, so this piece that Yuval and I co-wrote that'll be coming out soon, we say there's basically four constructive roles that Congress needs to play as this continues to unfold. One is just the ongoing legislative role, right? There's going to be more legislation that we're going to need, and it needs to be ready to do that. Second is an oversight role in two parts. The first is ongoing oversight, not just the sort of defensive, protective checks and balances oversight, although that is also important, but just the affirmative oversight of making sure that questions that need to the questions that need to be asked are asked, and that answers that might go unheard are raised. So just the affirmative role of trying to aid the administration in its own work, but then the longer term oversight role of laying down, constructing in advance what oversight is going to look like someday in hindsight, right? We're going to have a 9/11 commission style commission for this. It's unavoidable. And it's important for Congress. And there's a little bit of this in the first bill, in the bill last week, that starts to think in terms of a commission. I think ultimately it'll be broader than what Congress provided for in the bill last week. But we need to start thinking about imagine that you are building that commission or on that commission a year from now. What kinds of questions are you going to ask? Those are the sorts of questions we need to raise now so that the administration can think through what success or failure looks like and act accordingly. And ultimately, the COVID-19 commission, wherever it is, whatever it looks like, it's going to ask hard questions that we'll someday wish we had asked in the first place. So let's ask them now.
Let's talk about the governors as well. You had a piece in the Bulwark over the weekend, Trump versus the governors. And of course, this came after the president lashing out in very, very personal terms against governors that he doesn't like. The governor of Washington, Gretchen Whitmer, whose name apparently cannot remember, the governor of Michigan. And there were certainly suggestions that if the governors did not show appropriate appreciation, then he wasn't going to deal with them, or he wasn't going to talk with them. Now, he's trying to clarify this, saying that just means I won't talk to you. It doesn't mean that you're going to be discriminated against. But it really does raise this moment that at this in this national crisis, we are really testing the federal system. So what is this dynamic between the federal government and the states at the moment?
Yeah, and this is sort of the third part of disaggregation, right? Is not just realizing the proper role of information providers and Congress more generally, but also recognizing the proper role of the governors and the distance between the governors and the president. Now, of course, the president is always picking feuds. He's always done that, not just with Democrats, but with Republicans. And unfortunately, we have to deal with that dynamic in a crisis. Of course, the president has managed to get along with some Democrats. Astonishingly, he seems to be getting along right now with Gavin Newsom, whose ex-wife is the girlfriend of his oldest son.
That's not awkward.
Awkward at all. But in any event, what I wrote about in the piece was that in addition to that sort of personal dynamic, we now see there's sort of a structural dynamic. It's one of the unintended consequences of a relief bill like this, is where the governors and mayors are right now in the position of having to make really hard choices that impose immense burdens on the public, on the economy, right? The governors are the ones who first and foremost are imposing pain for the sake of protecting us from the virus's real pain. Well, now the president, very differently, is in the position of playing relief officer, right? He's the one now. He doesn't impose a lot of pain, but what he does do is hand out benefits to help stimulate the stock market and protect us in our day-to-day life in order to be able to pay our rent and buy groceries. What I'm getting at is the governors and the president are now dramatically differently situated, both in what they can do and also in a way what their incentives are. The president's really focused on re-election as much as anything. He always makes this clear, as we saw with his tweet on the Nielsen ratings. When the president is out handing out relief and trying to put a floor underneath the Dow Jones Industrial Average, while the governors are the ones who he can very easily blame for bringing it down, what happens when President Trump defines some county, he declares it to be medium or low risk, and a governor or a mayor says, no, this is still high risk, but or in any event, we need to maintain social distancing? Those conflicts could get very, very ugly.
No, this is a really great point. This is, you know, it may seem routine to have the federal government come up with those kinds of ratings, but there are real consequences to that. So, for example, let's take a state like, Wisconsin, where much of the state here, apparently have not been that many infections, and yet but the governor, Tony Evers, who's a Democrat, has issued one of these emergency orders. There's going to be some real blowback. There's a potential for blowback as people look around and go, I'm out of work. I'm out of a job. The economy has been hyped and has been hurt, and I have not seen any of these infections. So that's a problem. And so this is another way that Trump can really divide the country, the red and the blue, the people who have the problems versus the people who don't have the problems. And it really does create massive strain. And as you point out, look, the president can blame the governors. The governors can blame the president. And so at a moment where you would hope that we'd all be pulling together and this is what unites us, you know, remember those fantasies like what's going to break the fever? What's going to end this polarization? Well, maybe some major national emergency, and you know that'll bring us all together again. Well, here we are in the middle of it, and we're as divided as ever.
Yeah, and again, we've seen some. There are some reasons for optimism, right? Again, President Trump with Governor Newsom. President Trump seems to be getting along with, unless I've missed anything lately, getting along better with Governor Cuomo. These are helpful. These are hopeful signs, but this again is where information in the long run is so key that the president's briefings cannot be the central focus of expert information anymore, because there's just too many conflicts of interests in the relationships between the president and his base, the president and other parts of the government, the president and the governors. This really needs to be disaggregated out of this daily reality show White House press briefing.
You know, we've been focusing a lot on the economy, on the public health disaster that we're experiencing, and sort of off on the side, there are people who have been raising concerns about the future of democracy and the dangers of autocratic rule at a time of emergency. And it's always interesting to watch what other countries are doing. For example, Hungary. I don't know if you watch what the parliament did yesterday or maybe even in today. Viktor Orban, who's one of the leading, post-liberal leaders of Europe, hyper-nationalist, nativist, he's using this emergency to seize power in a rather dramatic way. So the Hungarian parliament has passed a bill that gives Orban unlimited power, proclaims state of emergency without any time limit, rule by decree. Parliament is suspended, no elections, up to 5 years in prison for spreading fake news and rumors, whatever that would be, and then leaving the quarantine. If you violate the quarantine, you might get up to 8 years in prison. So you have somebody who's already been an authoritarian who is using the coronavirus as the pretext to seize absolute power. And I'm not saying that's going to happen in this country, but this is a dangerous time for the rule of law, because you do have people who have shown a willingness to flex their muscle, to perhaps abuse their power, have tremendous incentives to do it, and very little resistance to it.
Yeah, my friend and former colleague Peter Berkowitz had a great column over the weekend arguing that in some ways the United States response to the coronavirus could, if successful, it can show the strengths of democracy and liberal democracy over authoritarian government. Let's hope so. I mean, this really is up on the world, on the global stage, at a moment of world history being made, a test case for American constitutionalism. But I would say that the difference, I hadn't seen what Orban had done in Hungary, but the essential difference between a real authoritarian and Trump is a real authoritarian wants power. President Trump merely wants to be seen as having power. He doesn't actually want power or responsibility or accountability. He wants to be seen as being powerful and influential. And so ultimately, and we saw this, with his sudden assertion he announced the Defense Production Act, but then there was a delay and he didn't want to use it, and he finally used it in a limited way. We saw him announce sort of a vague possibility of a quarantine of certain states. And right. Then he backed down off of that. Now, I will say, I don't know, I have no idea what he was saying, what he was getting at with the quarantine. But, where governors do play the frontline role on public safety, there is a role for the federal government and the president in protecting us against spillovers from one state versus another. That's something only the federal government can really do. But again, I don't want to digress. The point is that President Trump ultimately is going to seize opportunities to be seen as powerful and to declare victory, however he ultimately defines it. But he's never really going to do what Viktor Orban and others do, because he doesn't want the responsibility that they illegitimately claim for themselves.
That's a great point. Let's go back to this thing that you just raised, the president floating out the idea of an enforceable quarantine of mm-hmm. the New York area, New Jersey, Connecticut, and he backed off on that almost immediately. As people pointed out, that would be a terrible idea, and that he didn't have the power to do it. This is another indication of, and I think ought to be somewhat, before people rush to compare him to FDR, of the way that he appears to be making decisions impulsively on the fly, that it's a minute by minute sort of thing. There is not a broad strategy. So, yes, it's a good thing that he moved off either the reopening the economy by Easter, moving it to the end of April. But given a minute, This is the president who seems blown about by the advice he got from the last person he was on the phone call with. But I mean, for a president of the United States to float that kind of an idea, which and then basically acknowledge within about 12 hours that it was utterly half-baked, is not a confidence-building exercise.
You know, here the FDR analogy is kind of interesting. In 1932, he gave a famous speech where he said that combating the Great Depression would require what he called bold, persistent experimentation. He said, it's common sense to take a method and try it. If it fails, admit it frankly and try another, but above all, try something. So FDR himself had, you know, entered the crisis of the Great Depression with an experimental mode in mind. But of course, it wasn't like this, where the experiment lasted, you know, the experiment wasn't a media trial balloon, right? It was a grounded sort of fact-based policy on what would work and what didn't. Now, of course, there were huge problems with a lot of those policies as a matter of law or constitutionalism, but at least FDR's version of experimentation actually allowed the experiment to be a serious experiment that was run rather than these just constant, you know, media trial balloons that, you know, as you said, you know, just sort of casually announcing that New York might be locked down from the outside sets everybody into a panic for 8 hours. And then it says, oh, well, never mind. That is really the worst. That's some of the worst side of this style of presidency. It's the very opposite of steady administration.
Well, also, and I want to come back to something that I have been writing about over the last couple of days, and other people are as well, which is this mixed message coming out of the White House, and the fact that in fact that he has succeeded in tribalizing, or, you know, I don't know what would be, what's the verb for turning something into a cult. The reaction to this, there's really a great piece in the Atlantic about the different approaches that people are taking, that people aren't believing that it's as serious as it is. And I'm getting lots of emails from folks saying, look, you know, I live in this community, people are smart and they're decent, but they don't believe that this thing is as serious as the media has played it up. Therefore, they're refusing to engage in common sense social distancing efforts. And she's, you know, terrified about the result. And part of this is, and this is why I just want to push back on something. We have a great piece up at the Bulwark by Robert Trusinski about his old colleagues at the Federalist. There is this big push now to say, well, the original estimates of the numbers of death were wrong, and they have backed off from it. In fact, the Federalist ran a big story about this British estimate that there were as many as 2.2 million people that could die, and he's now dropped that down rather dramatically. And so Ben Domenech and others are saying, "We'll see. This is, you know, what a walk back, what a correction." Well, he's not. You know, they ran a story with the headline, "The scientist whose doomsday pandemic model predicted Armageddon just walked back the apocalyptic predictions." Well, that's not remotely what happened. This is the Imperial College team. And what they said was that here's what it would look like if, for example, Britain or the United States did not impose a shutdown and did not adopt strict social distancing policy. So he then comes back and delivers testimony to Parliament saying, okay, look, after Britain, in fact, did implement these policies we warned you to implement, it will result in dramatically lower infection and death rates. So that's not a walk back of the predictions. It's a confirmation of them. But you have folks like the Federalists and other people in right-wing pro-Trump media who are spreading this around saying, aha, here's what we've been telling you. It's not as bad as we said. And unfortunately, that may result in people not taking the steps they need to take to mitigate the problem. And so this is where it gets my head starts hurting about this, where it's one of those things where it changes, you know, these attitudes and this misinformation changes behaviors, which could change outcomes in a really deadly way.
Yeah, in real time as we grapple with the crisis. Yeah, I'd say in real time as we grapple with the crisis, the challenge, and this is something that our friend JVL has written about, and Megan McArdle of the Washington Post has written about. It's very hard for people to grapple with an exponential growth curve, right? You look out and you see one or no cases in your area. A week from now, it'll be 100. But it's just hard to envision that where things are growing by orders of magnitude. But then also the other dynamic you pointed to is that is just the confirmation bias of all this, that without, you know, the where Neil Ferguson's not the famous historian, right, Neil Ferguson, right, right. But the scientist, his initial predictions, they were couched in a number, or the full college report was couched in terms of scenarios and worst case scenarios and so on. And of course, the worst case scenarios are the ones that get our attention because we want to avoid those. The fact that we actually, the society actually takes on some of these mitigation efforts to great success. It doesn't, as you say, it doesn't disprove the model. It helps to confirm its success. The real, what I am very worried about is come November, when hopefully we've gotten through the worst of this, and things have worked out, and because of the success of social distancing and all these other measures and the more aggressive measures by the governors, we actually did bend the curve, and didn't see millions of Americans right. dying. That many people of the mindset of that you just exemplified, this article in the Federalist, are going to say that it was all a lie from the start. And I suspect President Trump, it's not that he'll join them in saying it's a lie, but he will say that, you know, but for him, the economy would have been even worse. And we're going to see such an ugly debate in hindsight over what happened. It will be
whatever the scenarios are, it will be an ugly debate. And I thought it was interesting how he moved the goalpost, saying that we may have 100,000 die, but that's so much better than 2.2 million. And he's pretending he never heard of that before, which is rather extraordinary. You know, if it wasn't for me, we wouldn't have, you know, we would have had so many more. Well, 100,000 deaths is a catastrophe, and obviously would suggest that it's certainly much more serious than the flu that's out there. But yeah, you are going to be having all of this. Now, by the way, James Holman from the Washington Post, you know, is out with his newsletter, and he pointing out this coronavirus model that's touted by the White House is actually assuming that social distancing will stay in effect through May. Yeah. Not just through April, but through May. This is Debbie Birx, you know, said that, you know, federal scientists reviewed a dozen different models how this might play out, and then went back to the drawing board. And she's specifically citing one by a guy named Chris Murray from the University of Washington, and that model suggests that not the end of April, but the end of May. And so, I mean, in his model predicts that April 15th would be when the demand for hospital resources reaches its peak, and he estimates that in the middle of April, which is, what, about 2 weeks from now, yeah, hospitals will be short more than 61,000 beds, short 15,000 ICUs, and will need more than roughly 27,000 ventilators. And he says that based on those predictions, you'll have, you know, 2,200 Americans dying on that day alone by August 4th. And this is the one that's being cited by Dr. Birx. Mm-hmm. He projects the coronavirus will have killed 82,000 people throughout the country. So how is the spin on this going to play? Because you know that we're going to go back to the economy versus the virus debate back and forth. And knowing this president being impulsive, it's not impossible for me to imagine that he will panic if the economy really tanks as people begin to realize this is not going away. And again, it's so unpredictable what the response will be and how it will be. And by the way, you know, you mentioned the way people will rationalize this. You know, once again, let's not sleep on the extraordinary shift in Trump world, the number of pro-life individuals who suddenly decided that restoring the economy, that we needed to save the economy, even if it meant mass deaths, even if it meant casualties, because there were so many more important things than just simply human life, which was an amazing, you know, an amazing illustration of the capacity for shape-shifting ideas.
Yeah, that's a conversation unto itself, right? Exemplified by Rusty Reno, editor of First Things Magazine. God, yeah. You know, I think it's a happy or poignant coincidence that, you know, one of the recent sort of readings in Lent in the Catholic Church, one of the recent readings was Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, right? If life weren't so important, Jesus might have told everybody, you know, to get over Lazarus. He's dead, but things could be worse. But rather that gospel reading is a reminder of the value of human life as God himself saw it. And it's just astonishing what people will convince themselves of. Can I just say a quick thing about the numbers, Charlie?
Yeah.
This week is so important for a couple of reasons. First of all, it is the week in which we'll see another dramatic growth in numbers. I just brought up the Johns Hopkins numbers. According to Johns Hopkins studies, on Friday, midday Monday, we're looking at 144,000 cases in the U.S. and almost 2,600 deaths. It'll be astonishingly more than that a week from now. But at the same time, we're now reaching the end of the first couple of weeks of social distancing, and it will be interesting to see, you know, with the lag time, you know, inherent in the coronavirus sort of manifesting itself. It'll be interesting to see what the data shows about the impacts of social distancing. Another former colleague of mine, Russell Roberts, the economist at Hoover Institution, just tweeted out a graph showing that things are looking, some trend lines are looking a little better for the United States. So we might get not just a lot of bad news, but hints of good news of how things might progress in a better way if we continue the social distancing and other measures. As costly as they are and as horrific as they are for so many Americans who are losing their jobs right now, but still we're going to see a couple of important trend lines manifest themselves this week.
Yeah, well, and you really have to hope that those trend lines work. We haven't talked much about the impact of the economy. And the $2 trillion package has been referred to as a stimulus. I think you pointed out it's not really a stimulus package. It's really just sort of a relief, a backstop for the economy. And my sense is that even though I'm very, as a conservative, very, very queasy about that much debt, it's probably not going to be sufficient to really cushion the economy from what it's experiencing right now, particularly because these shutdowns have become global. And there's real pain there. I mean, I don't want to come off as completely insensitive to the people who are saying, look, you know, there's a huge human cost to the number of people who are out of work, unemployed, have no sources of income, businesses that have been absolutely shattered. And that's, again, where you would really hope that you would have a firm, steady, rational plan for restarting the economy. My concern is that it won't be, that it will be, you know, sort of a Trump premature declaration of victory, or in many ways just as bad, very, very uneven. You know, this business starting because, you know, of ideology or whatever, this business staying shut down, and the patchwork that will, undermine the efforts that we've made to control the virus so that we really could end up with the worst of all possible worlds.
Oh, sure. $2 trillion is a lot of money, but it is a finite amount of money. And the extent to which we'll see industries lobbying publicly and privately to be protected, to receive some of those various pots of federal funds is going to be just astonishing. Just wait. Can you imagine the commercials that are going to air on Fox News during Fox and Friends, trying to get the president's attention for the industries that are being hurt the most and most need relief? This is going to be Hobbesian. It'll be nasty and brutal as companies try to survive.
They will. And you know, somebody was asking me why is Governor DeSantis reacting as he is, you know, refusing to shut down much of the state, and you know, despite the nature of the population and the threat. And you can imagine sitting there in the governor's office of any state. And business leaders are on the phone with you saying, you know, whatever you do, do not shut down my business. I can't, you know, we can't shut down the economy. And many of these governors are very, very pro-business oriented. And many of them have, you know, deep ties to the administration in Washington, but also, state and local. And I was trying to think what would have happened, you know, had there been a different governor here in Wisconsin. Somebody said, well, you know, would Scott Walker have done what Tony Evers has done in essentially shutting down non-essential businesses? And to be honest with you, my response was that really would depend what the Milwaukee Metropolitan Association of Commerce and Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce were telling him, what their agenda is. And by the way, I'm not predicting what that in fact would be, but there will be some governors that will just simply not want to get crossways with certain employers and industry until the problem becomes just too overwhelming. But I mean, you know, when you're looking at, you know, Dr. Burke saying the United States could see up to 200,000 coronavirus deaths, even if things are done almost perfectly, that does seem to focus the mind.
It does. And the task at hand for these governors and other elected officials who really believe in conservative principles and limited government, this crisis is an unprecedented challenge to so many of our own, yours and mine, sort of presumptions about the role of government. It's very, very hard to grapple with this, even in total good faith. I think back to when President Bush signed, I can't remember which bill it was, but at the very end of his administration, amid the financial crisis, with one of the bailout bills, he said very frankly that it was going against his basic principles of limited government, but he was doing it anyway because the crisis called for it, and that's what this crisis today is calling upon elected officials to do, and they won't do it easily, and we shouldn't want them to do it easily. Principles are important, and it's hard to sort of find the limiting principle to those basic principles of governance. And at the same time, whether both the president, Governor DeSantis, and others, there's always an opportunity to shift accountability, right? Either shifting it upwards towards China, which does bear a lot of responsibility, or in Governor DeSantis's position, I'm sure he'll end up shifting a lot of the blame down to the county level and city level officials, right, who in his absence were either closing the beaches or not closing the beaches. He'll always be able to say it was somebody else's fault. And the challenge of our system of constitutional government is making very clear who is responsible for which decisions, and holding them responsible.
Anything else that we should be keeping our eye on in the next couple of days?
Other than the Tiger King show on Netflix, I think we've basically covered it.
You know, I feel like I'm totally left out because I have not even checked that out. I'm doing other things. Oh, by the way, just a recommendation if you're looking for something to read, as we all are these days. You know, HBO has started the serial of Philip Roth's novel, the alternative history novel, Plot Against America, which imagines the 1940 election if Charles Lindbergh had defeated Franklin Roosevelt, how the world would have been different. And so I'll be honest with you, the HBO series has been going a little bit slow, so I actually downloaded the book, the Philip Roth book, which I'd never read before. I don't, you know, and it feels so timely.
Okay.
And where the value lies is just reminding people how pivotal certain events can be and how contingent certain events can be. You think about how the world would have been different had you had an America First isolationist, anti-Semitic president in 1940 versus Franklin Roosevelt, who was a deeply flawed political figure, made lots and lots of mistakes. But what that would have meant for the world, it's a great read, particularly now. And I'd be kidding if I didn't think that it felt like it was resonating a bit.
Well, you're a braver man than me, Charlie. Right now, when I turn on the TV, I'm looking for things that remind me of nothing with the current situation, and therefore a reality show about crazy people plotting against each other over their tigers is my kind of escapism, and old baseball games.
Okay, I'm in favor of that. See, I divide my time between playing with my puppy and reading these sort of dystopian alternative history books. Adam White, thank you so much for all your time this morning. Thank you for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.